Hello there, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. Lots to get through in this week's programme. As ever, we would love it, please, if you like, comment, share and subscribe as you go on this journey over the next half hour or so with us. And before we do that, though, I have to advise you that we have a fantastic free bets offer. More news on another exceptional offer as we progress through the programme. But first of all, we have news stories to discuss. And joining me, Lee Mottershead, in the studio. I'm joined by my excellent colleague, Jonathan Harding. Good morning.
Morning, Lee.
And at his home near Newmarket, I'm joined by another excellent colleague, our Deputy Industry Editor, Peter Scargill. Hello, Peter.
Morning, Lee. Morning, John. Sorry I can't be with you this week.
Well, we'll miss you, but we've got you remotely. That's better than nothing, Pete. And actually, you're going to kick off with our first story. As we progress through the programme, we'll be looking at the sport's new governance structure in Britain, 6 months on, as it faces an acid test. And we'll also be examining the week of Guinness trials at Newmarket. But Pete, before we move into your story, news developing this morning about Brave Man's Game being able to run at Punchestown on Wednesday. And of course, that links to the John Dunn story that you've been covering for the Racing Post these last few weeks. Just give us an update, would you?
Yeah, I'm going to be selfish and sneak in two stories today as a result of this. So, yeah, just as we were coming on, there's a statement from the BHA outlining what's going on with Brave Man's Game. So you may recall Brave Man's Game was blocked from running at Aintree during the Grand National meeting. The BHA had done a sort of a deal that had allowed Brian Drew, who's the co-owner of the horse, to sort of take control. Seemingly there must have been some kind of a lease deal, because subsequently this morning they put out a statement saying that following an independent valuation, the FCA have cleared Brave Man's Game to be sold entirely to Brian Drew. So Brave Man's Game is no longer John Dance's horse, and he is now entirely Brian Drew's horse, and as a result he is able to run a Punchestown on Wednesday, which is excellent news as a racing fan, and obviously a development in the John Dance story that's been playing out, but with limited information available, really. It's been very closely guarded what's going on, and regulators, racing regulators, like the BHA and the HRI, and financial regulators like the FCA are all sorting it out behind the scenes, and we're picking up what we can when we can.
Pete, thanks a lot for that. It is clearly a worrying case for all involved with that John Dance racing setup, but another worrying case was reported on by yourself, Pete, last week, involving trainer Robin Brisland and a senior member of his staff.
Oh, Lee, this was just a dreadful story. It was a dreadful story. It was it was this time last week, last Monday. There was a BHA disciplinary hearing. We knew that Mr. Brisland and Mr. Degnan, William Degnan, were the two people going in front of the disciplinary panel. Serious charges, J19, which is bringing racing into disrepute, and another rule D 22.1.2, which is to do with making sure the staff are looked after appropriately. So we're all set to go for that. And as it happened, there was a deal done at the last minute, a plea deal done, which resulted in fines for Brisland and Degnan. But it revolved around some quite shocking treatment of staff, which was accepted in terms of the behaviour towards the staff. It was a toxic culture, the BHA said, had developed at this yard during late 2020. Stories of staff being verbally abused, being made to cry, being afraid, and a couple of particularly striking examples, as it turned out, in terms of the reaction that people had. Staff getting injured whilst they were at the yard and being forced to ride horses either immediately or subsequently. So it wasn't a pleasant experience to be there, and it wasn't a pleasant thing to have to hear about, really.
But do we know how this case came to light, in the sense that did the individuals who were affected, did any of those complain or report matters to the BHA or to the National Association of Racing Staff?
We have limited information, really, because of the way it played out. So, like I said, we were all set for a 4-day hearing where there was going to be lots of witnesses and you know, people were having the opportunity to have their statements cross-examined. In the end, we basically had about half an hour whereby a broad statement was read out by the BHA. To their credit, they put it into the record to allow us to report what happened. But a lot of the details around it, we don't know. So it almost certainly was brought by members of staff. I think there were 4 complaints against Degnan and 6 against Brisland. And as far as I'm aware, most of the staff were, if not all of the staff, were prepared to testify during the hearing. So it was a result of that that they came forward, and it was something the BHA stressed afterwards, that they said they'd been involved in the process of the plea bargain and they were very happy. Now, obviously, we have to take the BHA on trust on this, and you know, whether these fines and what have you are truly something that they approved of. Say we have to say the BHA on trust because we haven't heard from them. But yes, it was brought forward by the staff in the first place, is my understanding.
Presumably, Pete, if the case had gone to a full hearing, the fines that Brisland and Degnan received, £8,000 and £3,000, that their punishments could have been significantly greater. Would we expected much greater punishment?
Well, almost certainly, because you know, these fines were came about as part of a plea agreement. So Brisland and Degnan accepted their behaviour and apologised. So, you know, as part of the mitigation in that case, you get the fines. And again, the BHA were saying that, you know, the fines are more damaging to these guys in terms of, you know, having to pay them back than a licence withdrawal. Again, we've got to take them on trust there, haven't we? To me, a licence withdrawal or some kind of specification, what am I trying to say, some kind of additions to their license in terms of safeguarding would be more appropriate. But yes, because of the way it came about, and it was quite a late plea agreement as well. I think it only came up on the Friday before the hearing on the Monday. So again, we've got to take the sincerity of the apologies on trust, because previously there was mention in the hearing on the Monday that they'd been uncooperative in interviews, or they hadn't really appreciated what they'd done, and they said, well, you know, we treated the staff that way because they were rubbish staff. You know, in the end they've apologized and we have to accept that, but I don't know, it's just there's a disconnect in there to me, Lee, and I can't square it even a week on, even having heard other people, we even haven't had correspondence with the BHA. I don't get it.
Has there been any suggestion that either of the two guilty individuals wishes to make some sort of public comment on the matter? You say, Pete, they have apologised within the hearing, if you like, the brief hearing, but we've not heard from them, have we, to hear their perspective on what took place?
No, I contacted the National Trainers Federation last week. Robin Brisland is a member of the National Trainers Federation, and there was no comment coming back by that route. So as far as we're aware, we were left with the statements that were put out via their solicitors on the day. And, you know, they were frank apologies. You know, they accepted that they behaved in a way that they let themselves down and let racing down. They sort of said, you know, in Brisland's case, it was a very stressful time. It was during COVID and made things difficult. But, you know, he knows he shouldn't behave that way and he won't do it again. With Degnan, his solicitor said his defence would have been that, you know, he wasn't driving this toxic culture. He was a result of it, because whilst he was the de facto head lad, he was actually only a stable hand, if that makes sense. He wasn't any more senior than anyone else, so it would have been unfair to say that he was driving this because he was no more senior than anybody else. Again, this is all taken on trust, and this is what troubles me about it, because of the way it came to pass, and seemingly a very quick resolution was made. I mean, it must have been months going into this to get to the point where it was going to be a 4-day disciplinary hearing, and presumably it was 4 days because there were going to be a lot of witnesses. So having gone through all of that, were the witnesses, were the people who were involved sort of pleased with mid-range fines, with how it all sort of came out, with apologies, you know, was an apology enough in the end? Was it, say, seemingly it was, because we have to take it on trust that it was, but I still don't personally feel that racing has been done a service by this, and I don't know, I think it's even questionable whether the staff have. It's just say, just my opinion, but I just, it was so shocking. It was genuinely shocking sitting there listening to what these people have been put through by Degnan and Brisland.
Absolutely, yeah. And Pete, I'll come back to you on this one in a second. But Jonathan, Pete says he was shocked to hear what they had gone through. And certainly when you read the stories about what they had experienced, the behaviour from Brisland and Degnan was disgraceful. Almost hard to believe that a modern employer and a team member could behave like that. What was your reaction to it?
I think exactly the same. Reading those details, it's unacceptable for any workplace in any year, let alone 2023, where, you know, we need to be aware of these things and fostering a culture that makes people feel safe and included. And at a time when racing is trying desperately hard to attract staff, it's hardly a wonderful advert seeing those sort of things published about horrible details and horrible treatment. And I think there's a couple things that perhaps come from this. I agree with Pete. I think they had an opportunity here to really almost make a statement, and seeing a mid-range fine for what was essentially a pretty harrowing and extreme example, I was a little bit disappointed with. I'm not sure I fully buy the idea that paying a fine is more of a deterrent and more of a something that will put others off behaving similarly than a ban or a suspension of a licence. But again, the BHA, you've got to take them on trust that they feel that's the right thing to do and the right kind of sentence. And it does raise a question about people in these positions, how much training are they having as part of their modules in the management of people? You know, it's being a trainer is not just getting horses fit and race planning and all those other things we know it is. It's also managing a team. It's also looking after people's individual needs, creating a workplace that makes people want to come to work in the morning. And it's worrying. And then you read, sort of had a bit of correspondence with people, and somebody got in touch to say, well, and a letter in our paper saying, when I was working, I wasn't given a full-time contract because I hadn't had a telling off yet and they didn't know how I would take it. You know, that kind of culture, which I'm sure is so, so very rare, and it's very important to get that out there, that most yards, I'm sure, are brilliant places to work, but it's just, it's not a good advert for what it is to work in racing. I don't think it's not representative of what it is to work in racing, and hopefully it's a sort of warning of, if things start to go that way in other yards, this is what it can lead to, and it needs to be nipped in the bud.
And just picking up on that point, Pete, that Jonathan makes, said that it's not representative of the industry as such. And George McGrath, the National Association of Racing Staff chief executive, agreed when he was talking last week. But he did reference something that I thought was interesting. I put to you, he said, there remains a culture in some yards that's not acceptable, and people are spoken to and treated in ways that wouldn't be if they worked somewhere else, like a post office or a restaurant. It needs to be the case that it's not just pay and conditions that are improved, but that people employed are treated with respect. I know this is something that the Industry People Board are championing. That was an interesting aside, if you like, in George's commentary on this.
Absolutely, and George obviously is very well versed in what's going on with the staff. Now, look, John is right. It is very important to say that there are some excellent employers out there. There are great paying conditions, wonderful opportunities to work with horses and travel the world and do all sorts of things. There are plenty of positives to being in racing and being stable staff in racing, but it can't just be the case that people get paid more money and, you know, maybe their hours are changed, but because they're at the bottom, because they're the guys mucking out the stables or feeding the horses or going to the races, they're not regarded as important, particularly, you know, a lot of them are coming into the game, they're younger, you know, and even if this is how it used to happen in the olden days, you know, it's a tough game and you need to be toughened up, and, you know, that's just how it is. It's just unacceptable for people to be that way, and it's not going to help drive people through the sport, because people are going to think, well, why do I want to go into an environment where it's almost feudal in a sense? You know, it's hierarchical, isn't it? I mean, sort of overtly hierarchical. That you've always got to earn your stripes to go up, and once you go up, you can talk down to people. It isn't a healthy position to be in. And, you know, to go back to John's point about the message that it sends out now, I mean, my understanding is that you've got to a position now where almost staff are self-regulating, i.e. they're saying, well, look, you, I've heard about this yard, or I've been in this yard, you don't want to work there, you want to work somewhere else instead. So they've almost had to adjust to a lack of appropriate oversight and appropriate punishment by doing these things themselves. And that's no position to be in, is it?
No. No, it's not. A really, really desperate case. And I suppose the hope would be that if there are any other employers behaving in the way that Robin Brisland had behaved, that this will represent some sort of wake-up call for them and they can change their ways. A second story this week is about British Racing's governance and strategy plans. I wrote a special report for the Racing Post that went in on Sunday's newspaper. It looked at the new governance structure 6 months on, or roughly 6 months on, from its birth in the early winter of last year. The big change in that structure was that the ultimate decision-making body in the sport now is the BHA board, having arguably previously been an organisation called the Members Committee. The BHA board is fed into by three separate main committees. One of those is crucial at the moment. It's the Commercial Committee, a body that has an independent chair, BHA chair, board member David Jones, with the chief exec Judy Harrington and the chief operating officer Richard Wayman, plus five racecourse representatives and five representatives from the participant groups. They are at the moment looking at plans for the 2024 fixture list. Key to those will be the concept of premierisation, whereby efforts are being made to shine a greater spotlight on the top Saturday fixtures and also to boost betting turnover, particularly on Saturdays. And in order to achieve that, the current plan is that on Saturday afternoons there will be a protected window between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. in which only three meetings are allowed to be staged. Those meetings that aren't permitted to be staged within that protected window will have to take place on either Saturday mornings or Saturday matinee slots or Saturday evenings or potentially even Sunday evenings. Now, to this point in the new governance structure's life, there has been remarkable harmony. Old foes have become friends. People have been working close together, even those who didn't in the past see eye to eye. But now we are facing a crunch time because those who represent small independent racecourses are fearful that these planned changes will have a huge impact on the commercial profitability of their racecourses. They say that staging meetings in the morning or at matinee slots or evening slots just isn't as good for some of them as in the afternoons. And that potentially, whereas the BHA has hoped that when decisions are made with this new structure, that those who maybe won't get what they want out of the decisions will still go along with it in the greater good of the sport, there's a real fear and a real prospect, I think, that these small racecourses, some of them at least, will take legal action against the BHA if the board does ratify and approve these plans, which could come to the board as soon as the next BHA board meeting in late May. She just says, well, just on a point of detail, in terms of the meetings that go into that proposed protected window, they will be largely determined on attendance figures from 2022, with a few caveats, including the fact that if you are at a meeting with ITV coverage, you'll get in. And if you're a racecourse that has been staging a BHA-owned fixture, as opposed to a racecourse-owned fixture on those Saturday afternoons, you wouldn't be eligible for that protected window. But racecourses like Thirsk and like Kelso and Musselburgh have been very vocal in their opposition to these plans. And the harmony that has existed for these past 6 months, I think, could be set to end as soon as the end of May. Jonathan Harding, you often write stories about governance and strategy and racing politics. It's been a quiet old time on the racing politics front because everybody's been liking each other and saying nice things to each other and agreeing with each other.
Yeah.
But that's about to change.
Potentially, yeah. And I think this is a really thorny issue for so many reasons. I think the BHA is slightly... A lot of the rhetoric around the new governance structure was we're going to be able to be decisive and the greater good. And that's fine, but when you are decisive, there's going to be unintended consequences. And I think this is the first one where we've actually been able to see those unintended consequences coming. The question is then, do you press on anyway, knowing you're going to upset? We're not just talking a couple of people. This is going to be fairly wide-ranging. It's a difficult balance that has to be struck here, I think, with the fixture list, because you have to juggle the needs of betting turnover with the fact that racing is a spectator sport. And if you're one of those tracks that's being moved to a morning slot, it's not one size fits all. If you're a track that relies very heavily on betting turnover, you might be okay with it.
Yeah.
If you're one that relies very heavily on getting people in on a Saturday and maybe they watch the away fixtures and there's a bit of a local feel to it and the community come in and all the rest of it, then you're going to be wondering, well, I've just lost a prime spot for what people want to be doing with their Saturday. You don't want to be going to a race course at 9 a.m, I don't think. So it's really difficult, and there's just so many unintended consequences, aren't there? There's that, there's then if there's less spectators or fewer spectators, sorry, there's fewer on-course bookmakers in terms of their interest. It's a really difficult time. For ages and ages and ages, I've been talking about getting decisive action, getting people around the table and actually making decisions rather than just vetoing for months and months and then just binning it off. I understand this premierisation urge completely. If I was to fulfil my dream of running a quaint little bookshop, I would make sure the front window was really nice. It makes perfect sense. But that can't be at the expense of the rest of the shop, if you'll forgive the convoluted analogy. You know, you can't put the big meetings, make them so prominent that the others suffer. It has to be a little bit of give and take, and it's hard to see where the carrot is for those smaller independent tracks. It's not a case of, well, you just move slightly, but we'll give you this incentive, or there might be this little thing that can help you wiggle out of it. It seems to be, this is a situation, like it or lump it, and that's where the fun's going to start, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Pete, before I ask you about premierisation, in your role as deputy industry editor, would you agree that the last few months have represented a rare period of calm in the sometimes difficult relationships between some of the sport's key stakeholders?
Oh, it's been frightfully dull, Lee. Terribly dull. This isn't what I'm expecting at all. I've become used to people arguing. I enjoyed some of the quotes in the piece that you wrote about how there'd be stand-up rows and people were fighting with each other all the time. This is what we've come to expect from governments. You know, this is what Bill Barber and I do most of the time. So yeah, look, it's been a period where there has been a lot of, on the surface, you know, people getting along and trying to move towards a direction. Now, I don't know whether that's because of a result of the changes to the governance. I don't know whether that's because people know that things aren't going very well and they need to sort something out, or whether it's just because it's a bit of a phony war at the moment, because it sounds like, based on what you've reported, Lee, there's going to be a real war coming up quite soon in terms of racing politics.
And on that subject, Pete, of premierisation, in a column piece I wrote today, I've made the general point that, listen, this, a lot of the principles behind premierisation make absolute sense. As Jonathan was saying with his bookshop analogy, you want your shop window to look fantastic, but you have to think about those unintended consequences and ask, is the price that some racecourses might have to pay for premierisation worth it? And I also argued that what you've got here is a change of not just strategy, but also philosophy, and saying that increasing betting turnover is a price for which falling attendances is worth paying, that we're prepared to sacrifice losing people going racing on Saturday afternoons in order to boost that betting turnover. What's your take on what's being discussed here?
Well, racing needs more money because we're struggling as a result of having extremely uncompetitive prize money. You know, we're losing horses, we're losing owners as a result of that. So clearly, betting turnover, increasing takeout, maybe some changes in the white paper that might help with the levy collection process, for want of a better term, might all help on that front. So, I mean, that, you know, that has to be a driver in these things. We can't just all carry on and say, well, you know, what about this person? What about that? You know, the sport needs more money. There's money out there and it needs to get more of it into the right places. I agree that Saturday afternoons, particularly during the flat season, are incredibly cluttered. You know, you have far too much racing going on. It's almost impossible to follow. So I don't know how, you know, keeping that status quo would be beneficial. So, you know, they're clearly trying to find some kind of solution to that. Whether this is entirely the correct solution, I don't know. I appreciate small courses, in particular, it seems, might be getting a slightly rough deal in terms of people coming to the course. But I don't know, do you need to work harder to get people in? We can't just all throw up our hands up and say, God, no one wants to go racing in the morning or in the evening. You know, does there need to be a change in attitude rather than saying, well, I don't like this, I'm calling my solicitor and we're going to... Because, I mean, that's just showing that racing's never going to work, because people talk a good game and then they never put it into practice. I mean, the only other thing that struck me, Lee, reading your piece, and you'd be able to answer this potentially better than I am, but a lot of it seems to be based on Peter Saville, the former BHB chairman's premierisation plan, or premier racing plan, that's sort of been picked up and run with. And I find that sort of slightly troubling in a way, that someone from the outside, albeit someone with a loss of experience and knowledge, has kind of had to come in and tell everybody what to do, and everyone sort of nodded their heads and gone, oh, this is a very good idea, we'll go with this. Is that how it is? Because if that's the case, can we really believe in the people who are leading the sport at the moment?
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Pete. I think that people within that the commercial committee that have been discussing this plan would probably argue that what they're talking about now, this idea of premierisation, if you like, is based on what Peter Saville had presented, but has developed since then. But I do take your point about, did it require someone from the outside to come in with this idea? I'm not entirely sure it's that new an idea, though, this idea of premierisation. We've often spoken about trying to find ways of making people more engaged with the sport's top-end product. And generally, it hasn't worked. And I think, Jonathan, just finally, one of my concerns here would be that we're not actually doing anything with the top-end product. Mm. You know, all the action has been taken away from those big two or three meetings that take place on a Saturday. What the sport is surely crying out for is to have more investment in promoting those top days. But the marketing spend within British racing is so derisory compared to other jurisdictions that it feels like we're having to almost play around the outside and not really deal with the core issue, because we haven't got the money to do anything with it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I know our colleague Scott Burton wrote a column to that effect. I can't remember quite when that was, a few weeks ago. But British racing does a lot with a very limited marketing budget, and creating space around those meetings does make sense, but that is a little bit sort of tidying up the edges rather than actually looking at promoting and getting that core product as good as it can be. I mean, relative to other sports, the marketing spend is paltry. Now, of course, you're not going to be the Premier League and pushing hundreds of millions into marketing. That's not in that ballpark, unfortunately, but I think you're right. You need to, it's not just about kind of giving them space, it's about making them as good as they can be, and that's a slightly more complex issue.
If we're talking about the sport's top end product, then two of the sport's top end races are about to take place seamlessly. The 1000 and 2000 games come up at Newmarket a week on Saturday and Sunday. We had the classic trials, the Guineas trials at Newbury and Newmarket last week, sandwiched in between the Grand National and the Scottish Grand National.
It's a weird feeling, isn't it?
A lot happens in a few days.
Yeah.
What was your take then in our third story on those Guineas trials, in what was a big week as well for Ammo Racing?
Yeah, it was strange because we have all these classic trials, but I'm not sure we're any closer to really knowing who's going to win those races, certainly I'm not, in the sense that a lot of the big hitters, the August Rodans of the world, stayed at home. So we're still sort of living with the idea of, well, if he's trained on, then he's going to be very difficult to beat in the 2000 Guineas. We then had Chaldean would be probably the notable exception of a horse that had a very big reputation coming into it. I think it was a sort of 5-1 for the Guineas, or perhaps even short, certainly the leading British hope. And for that freak unseat, we still don't really know whether he's trained on. We know that he's good at throwing a jockey off very occasionally, but it's just a completely freak incident. These things happen. Certainly haven't lost any faith in him. And then at Newmarket, do we potentially have the emergence of a new superpower in Ammo Racing, because they've had a wonderful strike rate so far on turf. They won the two big trials there. Chaldean's form actually got a boost with Indestructible winning.
Yeah, Craven.
But I think it was Mama's Girl looks to be the one that is potentially their biggest classic hope now. Probably about 6 or 7 to 1, I think, the last time I looked. It's changing all the time, but fairly short, single-figure price for the 1,000 guineas. And I think it's probably the key takeout for me from that week was it's only a matter of time before they start having a slew of Group 1 winners, because they've got some serious horses to campaign this year.
Pete, they really have. Before I get your view on the big winners from last week, what's your view on arguing with the biggest winner of all, Ammo Racing? Because their success rate is really accelerating.
It's a fascinating organisation, Ammo Racing. Kia Jurabjan, the sports agent, sports investor, who is behind it, it's basically his ownership vehicle. He is in this position that he talks about being a small owner. It's a lot of work. You know, we're trying hard to get up there. But his expansion in the last 3 or 4 years has been quite dramatic. I mean, he's been involved in horses for quite a while in one aspect or another, but it was only in 2020 that he's really exploded. Spent a lot of money, got a lot of horses. It's bringing in all sorts of new people to it, you know, new approaches with these, you know, very revved up, ready to go 2-year-olds that blast their opposition into oblivion and often go off favourites. And also he bought to us last year Omni Horse, which you'll recall we discussed on the front page back in November, which was his digital online even I'm struggling to exactly describe it. It's, you know, it was an online game with tokens, NFT tokens, cryptocurrencies, all those sorts of things. A lot of which was supposed to underpin the expansion in Ammo Racing, but I'm not entirely sure how buoyant Omni Horse is at the moment. So whether that's going to impact Ammo and the expansion that Kia has been going through in the last year or so in particular would intrigue me.
Interesting line as well from Kia, Pete, in a piece that James Byrne wrote in today's Racing Post, where he said it's still early days and we're taking baby steps crawling, but we're getting there. I mean, he must have the biggest baby in racing history, because I mean, they are firing out winners, and they're firing out big winners too. Indestructible in the Craven, Mama's Girl in the 1,000 guineas. Does either of those two horses strike you as a potential guineas champion?
No.
Not at all?
No. No, I mean, look, they both ran well. Mama's Girl was particularly eye-catching. I suspect she was slightly stronger stayer than the horses around her. Indestructible, I think they were talking about him looking quite ready in the paddock before the race. For the Craven, I wasn't there. I regrettably missed the Craven meeting this year. So again, perhaps he had some fitness on his side. But as John said, I mean, I think, you know, the likes of your Auguste Rodin's, Sakir, who galloped pro racing at Newmarket, Silver Knot, who galloped pro racing at Newmarket, they're probably your more likely winners in terms of the Colts Classic. In the Fillies Classic, obviously slightly unsure. I'm not sure what Dermot Wells doing with Tahereh yet. But again, Mama's Girl, you can't take away her course form. She's 2 for 2 at the course and she won a trial, but she doesn't strike me as quite having the requisite quality to win a race like that. But yes, I mean, the narrative that Ammo Racing are trying to put forward are there, you know, they're a small operation that's just going a little bit at a time and it's all early days and baby steps and all that. It's a bit false, really, because we know that's not the case. They've got loads of horses. They've got they spent plenty of money. They've got a very clear direction and set up, and they're making strides.
An even bigger operation, Jonathan Godolphin, perhaps didn't have the week they were hoping for at Newmarket last week. Good couple of wins on the opening day, including Ottoman Fleet in the Earl of Sefton. But as the week went on, they had some reverses, including in the Craven and then Hurricane Lane on Saturday in the John Porter. Were you used to them starting with a bang at Newmarket in that Craven week?
I really did, because I remember this time last year and going to Epsom on Tuesday thinking they seemed to mop up almost every single trial in the build-up or at the start of the season last year. they really hit the ground running. And it's not to say that they haven't. We just hold Godolphin to a very high standard. They're still having a fair few winners. It's just some of those slightly higher profile horses perhaps haven't quite hit the heights. I mean, we were talking about Hurricane Lane as potentially having another crack at the arc. I mean, his is perhaps a cautionary tale about getting too excited about the three-year-olds, because sometimes they don't, if they stay in training, they don't go on and do what we think they'll do as a four-year-old or even a five-year-old. So he was really disappointing. I'm sure they'll be disappointed with him, but again, it's so early day. We've still got all these, we've still got the jumps finale at Sandown on Saturday. You know, we've got a bit of time for those horses to come good. They might just be slightly further behind where they thought their three-year-olds were, but the quality is there, the breeding is there, so you've got to think Godolphin will have another, and Charlie Appleby will have another big year.
Do you agree with that, Pete? Is it just a week that the Godolphin team will be able to quickly forget once they start winning big races?
Oh, for sure, yeah. Look, as John says, we're used to them going off particularly fast. Appleby in particular, side Vincero tends to be a bit slower to come to the table now these days. You know, the ground at Newmarket was perhaps on the softer side to begin with. It dried out. I don't know whether that had any impact. Obviously, it was not very nice at Newbury at all, which might forgive Hurricane Lane, even though he likes that ground. You know, running on it first time out might not have been ideal. Look, Godolphin will be fine. I'm sure Sheikh Mohammed's not panicking too much.
I'm sure he is not. Okay, that then wraps up this week's edition. Before we sign off, I need to decide what the winning story from this week was. Jonathan, we love a week of classic trials, but we love a week of classics even more.
I know.
So when you come back and talk about the actual guineas,
I'll hold you to that.
You might win. I think my story about governance and strategy is monumentally important, but a bit like classic trials, we're still leading to a destination there. We haven't actually got there. So when we actually find out what's going to happen following the, presumably the next May BHA board meeting, we might give that a victory then. So Peter, because it was of such real significance and was such a desperately bad case, that hopefully will send out signals to anyone who might want to behave as Robin Brisland and William Degnan did. You have the winning story, sir.
A hollow victory, but a correct victory.
I quite agree. Definitely a deserved victory. Time then to say goodbye. Before we do, I want to advise you of an exceptional offer for the Racing Post Members Club. Yeah, it's a great offer that for the Racing Post Members Club. And also don't forget to download the Racing Post app on the Apple Store or the Google Play Store. That then is it for this week. Thank you, Jonathan Harding. Thank you, design Peter Scargill. And just to remind you, if you hadn't already noticed, that the government's gambling white paper is finally due to be published on Thursday. That will be given plenty of airing in the next edition of the Front Page, but until then, bye-bye.